All right, welcome everybody. This is Pat Allwell for a long-delayed Strategus podcast here with my two esteemed colleagues,
Todd Sohn
and Ryan Grabinski.
So we're going to cover the world as we see it based on our research and based on some observations. We've been all over the planet, I think, since the last time we chatted. Todd, where were you? You were in Vegas?
I was in Las Vegas. I think Ohio might have been in
between. Were you in California too or no?
No, California. And Atlanta, I think, as well.
Yeah, I was in Toronto, Montreal, Dallas, Houston, and Connecticut.
I can't think of two more extreme places than the politics of Montreal and the politics of Austin, maybe.
You know, that was evident in all of the meetings too. There's a clear dislike for the United States when you're in Canada these days. They just don't understand the policies that Trump is ultimately trying to enforce. And then I would say even when you go south in Texas, there's even some, I would say it's less concerns because they're ultimately willing to wait to see things through a little bit here. But there's definitely some concerns about an air pocket developing in the U.S. economy.
Well, you know, James Carville is famous for lots of things. One of the things he said was, it's the economy, stupid. The economy in Canada is, best I could tell, terrible. But they elected the Liberals again because of the Trump bump where he threatened Canada, which I think is a joke. No one's going to invade Canada and make the 51st state. But,
they
you know, they're taking it literally, not figuratively. And, of course, he sent a tweet out about himself as the Pope this past weekend, which had me laughing, but I saw in the Washington Post today it was the second most important trending story in the political section. But I was in Boston. Let me just go follow up on this Trump thing a little bit. You know, I was at a one shop where pronouns are described under the portfolio manager's name, but during a public presentation with Dan Clifton there, one of the portfolio managers said openly that someone's going to take that guy out, referring to the president, which I thought was a little bit extremist. But that's the kind of view that people have. In fact, now stocks are back flat to where they were from Liberation Day. But Todd, what's going on?
I was going to say the Canadian equity market, all things considered, is actually hung in there, right? Corrected like everything else.
That's because of four-letter word, gold.
Gold miners have helped. Gold has helped. But their financials are, some of them are all right still too.
I'd be curious if that changes though with some of the increase in supply in OPEC and where the direction that oil is.
The energy names there have been just, yeah. I threw my hands up weeks ago now on those.
Well, the energy names here are, you know, particularly weak too. I mean, it looks like some of the naysayers about U.S. production were right, that they didn't have the capacity, they couldn't do it, and maybe they wouldn't do it. But what's happened, I think, is that Trump is sort of playing Iran and Saudi Arabia. And for the Saudis to be increasing production into a weak demand environment, sort of extraordinary. And I think some of that weakness is coming from China, where demand, I still think, is weak. Now, I had got an email back from a friend down in Florida who's retired as a investment guy at a big insurance company. And he said, the reason why demand for oil is weak in China is because of EVs. I think that lessens some fuels, but at the end of the day, China is still the largest importer of oil, and they don't have the natural blessings that the United States has in terms of shale and other things like that. And all those electric cars that I saw whizzing around Shanghai a couple of months ago are all fueled by a four-letter word, begins with C, ends with L?
Coal.
Coal, that's exactly right. So what are people buying, Todd, in a feverish way?
Treasury bills.
Really?
Treasury bill ETFs. They're buying gold.
There's a treasury bill ETF?
There's a lot of treasury bill ETFs. Oh, yeah.
Really?
So you can buy all sorts of treasury bill ETFs out there.
Isn't that just like a government money market fund?
Yes and no.
Well, what kind of fees do they charge?
They're cheap. You can get 10 basis points, if not below. Low digits, single digits.
So it's an efficient way to buy treasury bills.
Yeah, without having to go to Treasury Direct.
Yeah.
You can do all sorts of fun things with that. They're buying that, they're buying gold. They have started to buy crypto again. And also, they have been using levered products recently.
This has been so when you say they are buying gold, is this institutional purchases of gold that they've noticed going up now, or is it the public?
I think it's both. Yes, me.
Okay.
Because I see it in the flow data every day, and that, depending on the size of it, could be institutions, like model allocations.
So why are they buying gold?
I think
because it's going up, it's a momentum trade.
I think
trade.
It's momentum. I think the other popular phrase would be portfolio diversifier.
Mm.
Right?
It's a little bit late for that, isn't it?
A little late for that, but that's one of the reasons why. And then geopolitical uncertainty.
But you always have geopolitical uncertainty. What's been extraordinary is the, you know, gold's been hitting basically new highs, new all-time highs throughout 2024. But when it pierced through 3,000, it moved up on people's radar screens. And then when it got to 3,500, it was on the front page of the Financial Times. I think it's a currency. I think it has something to do with the dollar. I think it has something to do with foreign central banks trying to replace the dollar.
Weaker dollar definitely helps.
Right. I saw Ken Rogoff is out with a new book on the dollar and is in The Economist and warning about the end of U.S. Sovereignty when it comes to the dollar, the exorbitant privilege. That would put upward pressure on rates too. Rebecca Patterson, formerly with Bridgewater, is in the Financial Times, the New York Times today, echoing a similar warning. I don't know why we treat some of the things that are so important here like redhead's stepchild. I mean, we're abusing our status here, and no one seems to be terribly worried about it.
I think that, I mean, the dollar is, in my conversations, especially, you know, when I have it with international investors, that's one of their biggest concerns right now. Not so much is the U.S. going to lose the reserve currency status, but, you know, what ultimately happens to the investment, what are the investment implications when if the currency goes from being 65% of the reserve currency in the world to 50%, right? But, you know, we haven't really we've never really invested in a secular downtrend in the U.S. dollar that appears to kind of be what we're heading towards.
Well, we haven't been anybody in this room. That's true, but in the 70s, the dollar was going lower. Because we broke away from the gold standard in 1971. It was called the Nixon shock, and that set the door open for higher inflation and all kinds of distortions in the currency. John Connolly famously said it was our currency, but your problem, that the United States, again, was acting arrogantly, and it would screw everybody else.
And that might be part of the reason why gold is ultimately, because they look at the 1970s, which is right. Really the last period where
gold went from $42 in 1971. It ended the decade at $800 and then collapsed. It hit its low in March of 2000, ironically, when the stock market was at a record high, and then it began to advance. And that was with central banks selling at that time. But again, I don't want to spend too much time on gold. Warren Buffett, God love him, is stepping down, and he once described gold is a big block of nothing.
Doesn't pay a dividend.
Doesn't grow, yet it has been outperforming. Didn't you tell me, Todd, even the NASDAQ 100?
I think so. That was something going around, yeah. Gold was outperforming. It depended on the date you started and ended it, right?
I think what's actually interesting is, coming back to Todd's T-bill comment, is if you look at yields on the short end of the curve, they're actually rising here again. The 2-year is sitting at 3.85 as we record today. And that, you know, to me suggests that, you know, that's the market taking rate cuts out of the market more broadly. If you look at the spread differential between the effective Fed funds rate and the U.S. 2-year, it's down to 47 basis points. And when it was at 50, 60 basis points a couple of weeks ago, everyone was screaming the Fed's behind the curve. So I wonder, if the 2-year yield rising here a little bit takes maybe a Fed cut off.
Well, it's still down low, but what say you? Because Mr. Barone has been of the view that the 2-year note has been screaming for relief.
I looked lower. We've bounced here a little bit. I just think that if you're an investor, depending on your time horizon, you can get the yield Ryan was just talking about and very limited volatility. So why would I even bother going anything above 7 years when there's more added volatility? Like, it's just a nice proposition there. Okay, I can get 380 to 4%. No, very limited duration risk and no volatility in the performance. It's just going to be a steady ride.
But it's under your cost of financing, right? There's a negative carry with the 2-year note.
I don't think many people are thinking about that, though.
Yeah, but the big banks and other institutions that speculate are buying the 2-year, speculating that they're going to make even a capital gain on that little thing, but the cost of financing, I still think, is north of 4%. And the Fed sort of digging their heels in. I know that the New York Times doesn't have the Fed whisperer Nick Timiraos on its payroll. But they have a story today when they quote Chris Waller as that, gee, the Fed's behind the curve here, but they want to be. I don't know.
I don't think they ever want to be. I think they just always are.
Well, they don't really know. You could put nine bakers together and come up with monetary policy.
But at the end of the day, the Fed has...
and better bread. And
they have the same issue that corporations have today, that consumers have today, and that if Trump backs off of his policies on trade, which it appears that he's doing at the moment, you could see a reacceleration of growth. And that puts that means if the Fed starts cutting rates, then all of a sudden they're too easy. And we know they're not an organization that just flip-flops from meeting to meeting on cutting to hiking. It's like, you know, 4 months of planning just to cut 25 basis points. And then it takes 6 to 24 months for that ultimately to work its way through the cycle. So, you know, we're probably giving them a little too much credit that 25 basis points is going to have a major impact. Here or there.
No, it's all about expectations. The market would probably sell off on that news anyway. Who knows? I don't know. The curve here, incidentally, just a note for fixed income managers, it was inverted for a long period of time. Typically, this recession didn't happen this time. Now, the first quarter GDP was negative. That was caused in part by the tariff disruptions. Whether or not it was gold coming over from Europe or inventories coming up, we're anticipating higher prices. But that is, as Donna's pointed out, this quarter should show an acceleration as people begin to chow down, buy down, let's say buy automobiles in anticipation of tariffs. But everything is going to go up in price, and that's going to make people who are already grumpy about the price of things get even grumpier. It hasn't happened. It's been in the press, but it hasn't happened yet.
Well, the things that are going up the most, right, are the coming back to the common man CPI, are the items that everyone has to pay for. So you think about utility bills, insurance bills. These are items that, you know, are increasing 7-8%. Regulators are actually passing these price increases through for one of the first times in a while. And consumers at the end of the day have no choice.
Regulators are passing the higher utility costs by because they're increasing the utility costs because of this green energy fiasco, which we see all the time. Let me just, it's a big, Spain. Let's talk about this big story that what no one's talking about. Spain had a blackout. Yeah. Portugal had a blackout. Parts of France had a blackout, and it was for more than a day.
Well, this tells me that the idea for the theme of additional needs for power generation in the U.S. is actually a global theme, right? It just goes to show you that there's a massive investment that needs to be made in Spain and Portugal, and if it needs to be made there, it probably needs to be made throughout the rest of Europe.
Well, listen, Larry Summers, who was critical of Scott Bessent for observing about the 2-year note, he said he didn't think it was a good indicator for the Fed, has said that, and I think it's a great quote, Europe regulates, the U.S. innovates, and China duplicates. And we'll get into all that in a moment. But the reason why, now, of course, we don't know, and I don't know, but it appears that the reason why the grid failed was that there was a slowdown in voltage of the production of solar power, which meant that the grid couldn't support the lower voltage, and normally you would have a backup. Let's say you'd have a diesel generator that would apply it at a certain thing, but the regulations prevent, God forbid, fossil fuels being used to back it up, and the entire grid collapsed. I think that's pretty big news, because God forbid you should be in New York. Yeah, and you've 24, 36 hours, 48 hours without the power in New York?
We did that. 2012. It's a fun one.
Wasn't that half of Manhattan?
I don't think it's going to be a very good look. I mean, if you're, I don't know whether or not there's looting or all the other stuff that accompanies power blackouts in Europe, but I know that in the United States it would be a very bad look for what would be going on. But we can talk about that a little bit later. Todd, what else is sort of standing out in your double leverage, hyper leverage, double short.
Yeah, leverage stuff has really gone wild on both the upside and the downside.
What, we talk about it, but are these? Do they have any money in them? I mean, is there billions of dollars in them? $110-120 billion
of assets.
Where are they borrowing from? Are they borrowing from banks?
Yeah, so they'll go to other counterparties like banks to get the swaps to do the trades. And I mean, they've been around, these types of products, been around for 17, 18 years now. So those are always popular, especially coming off of lows or during highly volatile events. And now the other newish corner is putting leverage on single stocks like Tesla and Nvidia.
Yeah.
You could make the case it's a way to play super high conviction, but sticking with that is really difficult. But so the amount of volume, though, that these products are doing now is at records.
Now, do these things decay if nothing happens?
Yeah, you need a market going straight up or straight down. You can't have a choppy market because then you're just going to get...
I saw talking about a choppy market, which the banks have been profiting from greatly. I mean, whether it's Goldman Sachs or Bank of America, the European banks all knocked the cover off the ball again because of the volatility created by the orange tornado.
The strangest part of all this is the MSCI EAFE is at a new all-time high, right?
European banks are leading. DAX too, right?
Yeah, DAX basically right there. It's not there. So Europe is arguably the best market on the planet right now.
I thought Latin America outperformed to Europe in the first quarter.
Well, dollars are local.
Oh, for Pete's sakes, I look like a Bloomberg. I
European dollars is one of the best markets right now on the planet.
So the other thing that's happened with the orange tornado is he kept the liberals. You said you were in Montreal and Toronto. He kept the liberals in power, which was a big surprise. It was one of the most stunning political turnabouts in modern history, where they looked like the conservatives were ahead by 25 points. They ended up losing by 2, but the way the seats are assigned, it's not quite a popular vote, not quite the electoral system, it's a parliamentary system. But Mr. Carney, who once said that the best fossil fuels would be in the ground forever, had done a turnabout. He lowered the carbon tax for individuals, and he did what politicians do. They changed their view to get elected, and that, I guess, is admirable. He's going to be visiting with you-know-who tomorrow in the White House. Mm-hmm. And Carney's a smooth operator, right? Alumnus of two very prestigious, the oldest central bank, the Bank of England, and then the Bank of Canada. But I'm told, I was in Washington a couple of weeks ago by a guy who knew him in the business somehow or another tangentially, that he's a little bit of a thin skin. So we'll find out what kind of politician he is. But the other guy that he's visiting tomorrow also is famous for a little bit of a thin skin, too. So maybe they could share skin tips.
How do you thicken each other's skin?
Recommend dermatology.
How do you thicken it?
It's the whole thing is just crazy. It's just completely crazy. It's nuts. So the other thing I noticed is Vanguard, which is the behemoth in the mutual fund business, created by the great late John Bogle, will not be investing or putting signs up in China. They say that the Chinese way of investment is not their way. They're long-term investors, and Vanguard believes that the Chinese investment community is too short-term, and they're not going to make any investment there. I thought that was interesting.
I think they had, maybe I'm wrong, they tried to build a business there. They're out of it now? You're saying they're backing out or not even?
They're not going to. I think under new management, they said they're not going to go.
I think one of the most interesting things about passive here, because at the end of the day, that's what Vanguard really is.
Absolutely.
Is that.
They got active funds. Big active funds, too.
If the Magnificent Seven doesn't work the way that it worked for the last 10 or 15 years, how does Vanguard react or change their tune?
Well, that opens the door up, Brian, to your bailiwick too. Is the number of active managers in the first quarter that outperformed just a quarter?
Yeah.
What's the number? Is it 58%?
Yeah, 58%. It's close to 60%. That's the best year for active managers since 2022.
Is it a year we're talking about or a quarter?
So year to date, this was through the end of April, 58%.
So we got 4 months. They got 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 3 years, 20 years.
It speaks to the underperformance of Magnificent Seven, because the last time that they actually performed well, active managers performed well broadly, was 2022, and the 2 years have the same thing in common. And then really for active management to work before that, you got to go back to before the financial crisis.
So if active managers are outperforming because they don't own much Nvidia.
Yeah, they don't own Apple 35% of their portfolio.
Tesla.
In seven stocks.
I did hear, it was down in Washington, and Chris McGrath, who's down there, works tirelessly with our ace, Dan Clifton, said that, and I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but from the market peak for Tesla in December to when he announced that he was stepping back from Doge, he had lost more market cap in Tesla than he had discovered in government savings.
that's a good fun fact.
It's a great, it's true. If it's a great fun fact, it's true. But ladies and gentlemen, if you're listening here, we would check this, spell check it, and check it again.
I was going to say the active stuff. The number of active equity mutual funds is at a 25-year low.
And you pointed out, I remember, Todd, when you, it was several years ago, it might have been in the August of 18 or August of 19, when active managers lost market share for the first time to passive funds. Was it?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, they still are. And that's why you're seeing active ETFs now really have the fire cannon go off.
I think this is why you're even starting to see other traditional long-only managers actually start to dip into the private space. I know, you know, we've talked about on this in the past with State Street, and I think I saw an announcement over the past week that there will be some other providers trying to do partnerships with private private credit, yeah, private equity to sort of grow their asset base.
So we were in Boston back to last week. We did a survey over dinner. It was a robust dinner. 60% of the people believe that tariffs are inflationary. Now, our team here doesn't see it. We see it as a tax. It doesn't make you wealthier, but it's a one-stop up. If it's accommodated by the Fed, it can be broadly inflationary. There are guys at the Fed, it sort of drives me crazy, who sort of see inflation as sort of an illness, a mental illness, that if people begin to think that inflation's going up, therefore it's going up, so they look at inflation expectations, which are nothing more than the price of eggs today at the local Shaw's or Christie's or wherever the heck, or Whole Foods, wherever they shop. But it seems to me that inflation is still a monetary phenomenon. The Fed created too much money, and that we had sent out checks, so we had fiscal and monetary policy on full bore, and prices went up, and you had the Ukraine war, which accelerated things, and voila, now the central banks have a major problem on their hands.
Yeah, it doesn't, I don't think it's going to be going away. I've been trying to think about, you know, what could potentially be the positive coming out of potential price increases here. And I know, you know, we talk a lot about how it's not necessarily inflationary, but if companies do hike prices and it does create a little bit of demand destruction here in the near term, as we come out of this slowdown, it actually means higher margins for the back half of the, or potentially later this year or into 2026, because we know once companies start raising prices, they generally don't lower them. And we're starting to see that. And that was, this was actually something that I heard in Texas. One of our clients was actually having I believe it was, you know, a geothermal installed at their house, and they were, you know, and to do that, you have to
drill.
They know a lot about drilling in Texas, right? And you know, he was told that if he doesn't sign the contract today, which, by the way, they weren't going to perform the work for several months, then it would be 10-20% higher if he signed in the future.
Yeah,
and there was, you know, the equipment is not changing from whether it's
there. Yeah, well, you know, there's no doubt that the United States, since the opening of globalization, has benefited from a lot more choice. Consumer surplus is what economists call it, and lower prices. Donald Trump last week, I think, said in a maybe a re-Antoinette moment, you know, maybe they have to buy 3 dolls this Christmas rather than 30. Yeah, yeah. As somebody who's had daughters and sometimes the end of bath time with the Barbie dolls at the end of the bath, it sort of looked like a mass murder scene with naked dolls twisted all over the place, some of them with their heads off. They were $4.88 for a basic Barbie at Walmart.
Pokemon cards cost more than that now.
What's that?
Pokemon cards.
Pokemon cards cost more than $4.88?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How much do they cost?
Depends on the store.
Does anyone play Pokemon other than odd Japanese people?
It's big. It's big. I got to buy them for my kids now. One store was $6 a pack. One store was $9 a pack. That's sort of.
And do you still are you still looking for the Charizard?
I got some new ones out there.
Really? Yeah. It's just that's like
that's the inflation barometer.
Pokemon. So who's the maker of these?
Is it Nintendo?
No. I forget the name of the company. Birdo, you know, who makes Pokemon?
Birdo.
Niantic, maybe? Maybe that's the game developer.
Well, we're going to have to look. We'll get back to you.
Yeah, we'll get back. Remember, I don't know. I think it's sort of like, what's that other one? Beanie Babies? Remember Beanie Babies? Oh, yeah. Remember there are people who actually recommended Beanie Babies as an investment?
That was me.
Really? How'd that work out for you? Oh. You just sold one for an auction for $12 million.
Lucrative.
Well, I don't think there's much else to... Unless there anything, you have anything?
I have nothing.
Payrolls are still good?
Yeah, I mean, the initial claims number last week was a little, it jumped a little bit, caused a little agita for a lot of investors. But, you know, all things considered, it's still below that 260 level that was the previous peaks. I actually think, you know, if you look at some of the gig economy stocks like Uber, for example, like the stocks are telling you that the consumers are still spending money, and until those stocks start to roll over, you know, it's hard to say that the economy is in too much trouble at this point.
Well, we'll be back perhaps a little bit sooner. And for that one Tony out there who likes listening to us, we appreciate it very, very much. A shout out to you. Thanks a lot.